Accession number 8192, roll number 5.
Brigadier Barclay, reel 5. Now, you say that you expected the Germans to attack through Belgium. Did you think that the Belgians would fight?
We had no great confidence in the Belgian army, I'm afraid to admit. This lack of confidence was well-founded, because when, in fact, the Germans did invade the forts on the east of the Belgian-German frontier, which took place at Liège and Namur, the Belgian resistance was next to nil. And one of our great problems, in fact, when we went forward, was getting German, Belgian soldiery off the road so that we could move into eastern Belgium to protect our country. We, in fact, had little premonition, little forewarning, although we did have premonition, but we had little direct forewarning of the German attack on the Belgian eastern forts. Although this was expected, and we'd, as I say, we'd planned for this eventuality. The first news we had was pretty sudden, early one morning, and in fact, I think it was Namur fell very quickly, and Liège took a little bit longer. We moved forward within a matter of hours, by transport to the line of the River Dyle. We were attacked from the air once or twice with very little effect. There was a certain amount of enemy air activity and very little response from our own people at that stage. And then we moved up to the vicinity of Wavre for to take up these positions that were pre-planned and pre-reconnoitred.
You say that it was early in the morning. How did the news arrive that the German offensive had
begun? Well, a message came through from... Well, the first we heard was an immense amount of shelling and bombing in the distance. And very soon after that had happened, the commanding officer received a message to the effect that this had occurred. And he stood us ready for... He told us to stand by for immediate embussing, because we knew as soon as this did happen, we'd be going forward to take up these pre-planned positions. And it was very soon after the first news we had of this that, in fact, we were on the move.
How long did it take you to actually get the battalion embossed?
Oh, I think the whole thing was completed inside a couple of hours.
And it was in daylight?
It was just getting daylight.
Who provided the transport?
Well, that I can't tell you. It was... the plans were in the pipeline for the provision of what transport we needed, but as a company commander, which I was at that time... I had no idea where it came from. I suppose the RASC were responsible for producing it. And no doubt it was lying handy.
So you got the chaps on the lorries and drove forward along your pre-planned route. Can you remember the route?
I can't offhand. I can refer to this and let you know, but I mean, I've got maps of it. I can let you know.
Was it a long journey?
I think it took about 8 or 10 hours, if I remember right. It took quite a long time, I know that, and we were delayed by refugees, and we were delayed by the retreating Belgian army, and vehicles that had tipped up by the side of the road, and there were various interferences, which slowed us down quite a bit at times.
It wasn't a steady advance then?
No, I mean, every now and again we had to be very careful not to concertina when we did stop, because obviously we'd offer a much better aerial target. We'd rehearsed this very carefully, and We kept distances of over 100 yards in between vehicles.
What about anti-aircraft defence? Did you?
Well, we had our own machine guns mounted on each vehicle. There were holes in the top of each vehicle, and then our own light machine guns were mounted on tripods to take on aircraft. I remember we weren't supposed to take them on at distances greater than 1,500 yards. Other than that, I mean, we could deal with that on the move. But there was no anti-aircraft defense, static defense on the roadside as we went along. We just provided it with our own light weapons in transit.
You said you were attacked from the air. What form did the attacks take?
Bombs. Bombs. Pretty inaccurate bombing. I think the refugees suffered more than we did.
So you didn't have any loss from this?
No, I think on the way up, I don't think we did have loss. I think we had one vehicle damaged, but we got through to our destination remarkably unscathed.
How did the Belgian refugees and troops respond to your appearance?
Well, the Belgian refugees cheered us forward like mad. They were going obviously in the opposite direction. But they were always very enthusiastic at our arrival and simply delighted that there was somebody going along who looked as though he meant business. It always helped their morale to see us. And, I mean, the soldiers, obviously, enjoyed their smiles and their waves and their cheers and the fact that they were in a position to help them.
And what about the Belgian troops you saw?
I saw no coordinated body of Belgian troops at all, I'm afraid to say. It was a case of individuals and small packets going in the wrong direction.
Did you see any officers with them?
Hardly ever.
So it's other ranks, basically?
Yes.
Going to the rear?
Yes.
And what sort of weapons were they carrying?
Well, they just had their own personal weapons. I never saw them humping anything other than what they would require for their own immediate protection.
So you didn't see any heavy weapons?
No, I didn't see any of that.
Did you see anything at all of any Belgian police or civil officials?
No. No, I don't recall any form of traffic control by a civilian peace organisation anywhere. What control was necessary was always done by our own people, and that was very necessary very often.
Now, you said that your positions on the dial had been reconnoitred in advance.
We had reconnoitred these positions beforehand, during the time, in fact, that we were digging the Gort Line in 1939. It was extraordinary performance because we weren't supposed to go in uniform, and so Mufti had been sent out for us, and we all went in an obscure range of Mufti suits by car across to the eastern Belgian frontier, and there on the ground we reconnoitred the positions we were to take up in the event of the Germans attacking from that angle, which occurred, and we knew exactly where to go and what positions to dig as soon as we arrived there.
When you went on this clandestine recce, did you have Belgian guides to assist you?
No, I think we did the whole thing from the map. We worked entirely off the map with our own commanders. There may have been Belgian liaison officers on a higher level. I expect there probably were, but I was not concerned on my level with any Belgian liaison at all.
When you got to your area of the line on the dial, what did you do?
Well, my job as commanding A Company, my battalion, was to take up the outpost position, which meant I was on the enemy side of the River Dyle, with the remainder of the battalion in position on the west of the river. And my orders, basically, in brief and practically identically, were give them a bloody nose, old boy, and then pull out. It was tied up a little bit better than that on other levels, but that's basically what I was told to do. I remember all this very vividly because there was a small chateau in the area of my company position, and there was a garden party going on, and there was a maypole with children whirling round the maypole, and Madame exercising her role of hostess superbly, and was horrified when I told her that we were going to have to dig trenches in around our garden. She said, as long as you don't upset the rose bushes and as long as you don't interfere with the rhododendrons too much, I suppose I can't stop you. But I said, well, I certainly curtail the garden party activities and send all these kids home because there's going to be all hell let loose here in the next day or two. And I suggest the children better at home. And she said, not to worry, her husband would let her know if there's any need for alarm. I said, well, where's he? Oh, she says he's in Brussels. I said, well, you can't get through to Brussels now because all the lines are down. Fifth Column must have been at work or something, but all the lines are down. And there's no chance of him getting him on the phone. Anyhow, the party went on, and we dug our trenches in among it all. And the first thing that happened was the phantom reconnaissance forces of our own, which were largely composed of light armoured cars from the 17th, 21st Lancers, whose job it was to get early information of approaching enemy, started to withdraw, come back through our positions, over the bridge, which was planned for blowing, and told us that Namur had ceased to hold out and the Liège would fall jolly soon by the sound of things, and that the Germans would probably arrive on the River Dyle the evening of the following day, or else jolly soon afterwards. So we, in fact, dug our positions that afternoon and during that night, and in fact the Germans appeared the following day, and the vanguard of the advance guard consisted of motorbikes and sidecars with machine guns mounted on the sidecars. And we knocked out about four or five of these, and then, of course, there was a build-up, which one could see in the distance, occurring behind them. And eventually I got the order to pull back over the river. Communications were very poor compared to the situation later on in the war. We had line telephone. Wireless telephone couldn't reach battalion headquarters. So such a thing as radio, powerful radio sets didn't exist, except for the gunners. And if the line telephone failed, we relied entirely on light signals from the very pistols.
And these had to be prearranged, presumably.
Yes, which all had to be prearranged. And were very confusing, very unsatisfactory.
Now, you say you were in outpost positions. What sort of front did you have to cover? How wide were you spread?
It was, I think it was about... it was about 600 yards I was holding as company, but it commanded the main road leading towards the bridge over the Dyle in our sector.
And what sort of positions did you dig?
Well, I had slip trench positions on a platoon, based on a platoon, three sections in each platoon, and I had, in fact, two platoons up and one platoon back. They had a very good field of fire from the position of this chateau's garden, and we covered this road from jolly good concealed positions, which we were able to prepare quite quickly and camouflage over, a vital finale to any digging, to any trench digging operation. And we did catch the leading mechanized German troops completely by surprise. And in fact, none of the first batch that appeared got back to report, but it obviously didn't take long before the follow-up troops melted out, and we were subjected to a great deal of fire.
What sort of fire?
Artillery and mortar fire. Long range, heavy mortar fire and artillery fire. And then, how long, I can't remember, but I think we, after first contact was established, we were there for about 4 or 5 hours. And then it was, then darkness fell, and we were ordered to pull out under cover of darkness and cover the bridge blowing party after we'd crossed over.
You said that you had a build up detected. How did you detect it? Could you actually see?
Well, I think we appreciated this mostly by the increased amount of fire, which meant that they'd got information that we were there, and probably their spotter planes, which they used quite a bit of, had located our position. But the fact that we'd knocked out several of their leading elements percolated back before long, and the likely positions along the river bank came under a lot of fire. In fact, the positions on the west bank of the river came under a good deal more fire than our positions on the enemy side of the river.
Was the fire that came down on you accurate as well as heavy?
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. They hadn't pinpointed our positions, and therefore it wasn't accurate.
It's speculative.
Yes, that's right. That's right. They were always quick to respond with fire, and their counterattack reaction always was, if not totally a counterattack of fire, it was preceded by tremendous bombardments of mortar and artillery fire on the positions at which they knew.
When the motorcyclists came up, how close did they get before you opened fire on them?
Oh, we let them get jolly close because we wanted to get as many as we could. I think the leading one was only about 150 yards away, and he was that was not 150 yards to our front, but 150 yards away from the position, which is the road is to the flank of this position that opened fire. And by that time, there were about 3 other motorbikes within range up to matters of about 600 yards.
Did they come on in a line or on a column?
Well, they were just these motorbikes and sidecars. Those were the first 3 things we knocked out.
Were they on the road, or were they going cross-country?
They're on the road. They're on the road. They're obviously the forward eyes, the moving formation that was approaching up the road.
Now, you mentioned you had a good clear field of fire from your positions. What was the terrain like?
It was undulating, quite considerably undulating, and also there was a lot of cover in the immediate vicinity of the chateau, gardens and rhododendron bushes and bits of woodland, but beyond that it was more open and you could get a reasonable view of what was coming the far side.
How far away was your horizon, do you think?
Oh, I suppose in the greater part of the sector it was about 1,000, 1,200 yards.
So you'd have seen them from a kilometre or more?
Well, there were a lot of clumps of trees and hedgerows and things like that. And until they got fairly close, one wasn't going to be able to pick them out unless they moved across the open country, which they weren't going to do until they came out of fire, obviously.
Did you have any casualties from the...
No, not at that stage. Not at that stage. We were lucky, actually, because there was a good deal of mortar fire and shell fire coming in our area, but it wasn't accurate, and we were untroubled when we withdrew, and we waited for the bridge to be blown up before coming over. As we came over the bridge, the River Darl Bridge, we covered the party that was doing that, and then we came home and moved into reserve position to the battalion in the battalion sector.
Who actually carried out the demolition of the bridge?
The Royal Engineers. There was a party with us that whose job it was to do that. Generally, they looked after the demolition of bridges, but not always. Sometimes when they were in too great demand, members of our pioneer platoon would carry this out.
When you were guarding the demolition, did you keep the whole company on the enemy side of the bridge, or just a platoon?
No, we weren't being followed up. We weren't in contact when we came over the bridge. And therefore, the bridge-blowing device was on our side of the river, and we were able to take our positions on our side of the river, covering the bridge in case of a rapid German advance before the job had been done. But it was done without trouble.
So you didn't dig positions, you were just...
No, we didn't dig positions, we just... It took very short time.
Was the effect of the demolition complete?
Yes, they did a very good job. Yeah.
How wide was the dial at that point?
It wasn't a very big river. I suppose it was about 40 to 50 yards. But a good anti-tank obstacle.
Was it a fast?
Not very. It wasn't particularly hilly country, and therefore it was a fairly slow-flowing river at that stage.
How far back from the actual bank were the battalion's positions?
Well, the forward elements were very close to the bank indeed. There was depth achieved by rear platoons in company areas and by companies in reserve in the battalion area. And when we moved in reserve, we were quite a considerable way back. But obviously you've got to be able to look down the river from these positions, and therefore the machine gun situated so that one could enfilade any attempt at crossing.
When you got to your position as reserve company, did you have to dig in?
Oh, yes, absolutely. We dug in straight away. And I remember, in about 3 hours, we had a complete dug-in, camouflaged reserve company position.
And was the ground on your side of the same as on the other side?
No, it wasn't at all. It was much more open and much flatter. But I really didn't expect to have to fight for those positions, although they were designed for that purpose, because I thought it was much more likely that the company would be called upon to put in a counterattack somewhere or reinforce some weakness where the Germans might have crossed the river.
Who was on your right flank?
The French. Which particular unit, I don't know, but we were at that time the right-hand battalion of the BF. And I had no direct liaison with the French there. No doubt the battalion commander had.
Were you within sight of their positions?
No, not as an outpost company commander. Well, the gaps were much wider on an outpost basis. The right company position on the west side of the river might well have been in contact with the French. I imagine he would have been. But as reserve company, I had no direct link.
How do your men reacted to coming into contact with the enemy for the first time?
Oh, they were marvellous. They were absolutely marvellous. It was a very well-trained battalion in that our numbers had been made up by reservists who'd only, for the most part, quite recently left the battalion, and therefore they were all well-trained soldiers and had got the spirit of the regiment fully at heart. They were marvellous, and they were longing for the balloon to go up during these tedious months we had beforehand. And they were absolutely steady. I never had any problem at all on that score. They were just raring to go, and their morale was tip-top, and they were a marvellous bunch of chaps.
Were they excited by this first?
Oh, yes. And, of course, to be sent out as outpost company was a particular feather in our caps, because obviously we'd be specially picked for the trickiest job to start with, and they got a lot of kick out of that. And they got a lot of kick out of the next job I had to do too, which I just got dug in, and I was sent for by my commanding officer, who seemed to be in another state. He said the Germans have crossed over the river on the right, and I said I'd have come under fairly direct fire if that happened. And he said, "Oh yes, they have," and it was very strange because the Edgerton didn't seem to know anything about this, and the colonel reckoned he'd had a message from a dispatch rider from brigade to this effect. And so he said, "I want you to recapture that village over there." And I said, "Well, that's a French reserve position. If they were in that village, they must be within visual range of anybody, any enemy were there." "Oh," he said, "they're all right. You go. You've got to go and recapture it." So the action was as amazed by this as I was. However, there you are. The commanding officer told you, "You've got to go and recapture a village. You go and recapture a village." And we prepared a fire plan with the artillery fire coming down on this place, hot and strong. Machine guns from a very good position, slightly to a flank. Mortars, the lot. And we started our attack. And I was just getting ready for the final assault. There'd be no retaliatory fire coming at all, which didn't really surprise me, because I thought, you know, the fire plan had obviously been so sound and so effective that it kept all the heads down. And just as we were going to put in the final assault, a British carrier emerged from the village, to my astonishment. I thought, well, these blighters, they've captured a carrier and they're using that now. And I got over to the chap with our boy's anti-tank rifle, which we had one of these in the company, and I said, "You get down behind that bank, and but keep your safety catch on, and be trained on that carrier, but don't fire until I tell you." And this thing got nearer, and I said, "Well, I'd take the safety catch off, but don't fire till it hits your shoulder." And as it came nearer, I saw a chap in front with a British tin hat on. He then proceeded to stand up and wave a walking stick. And I thought, well, no German would ever do that. So I told the fellow to put his safety catch on again and relax. And in fact, this turned out to be the commanding officer of the Royal Scots.